did we answer your questions as to what you're likely to get with your rabbit ear antenna on digital? Frank, we're going to get you right after Bill. WB2CUK, KQLIW.
All right, Dick. Well, I'm far from an official of Live Bar, but yes, I do believe that's what's going to be for the second Wednesday of the month. I don't remember the date either, but the info on that will be on Monday, tomorrow night, they'll announce it. And the only other question I have is there any digital broadcasting actually going on now that I can experiment, and are they going to come out with these little portable sets? I have probably three or four little black and white and I think one color set with 5-inch screens that work on an AC adapter or batteries, and they have whip antennas, and I was getting very good reception on a lot of the stations, not all of them. Channel 2 and 4 came in pretty bad, but 13 and 11 and 9 came in good, and 21 comes in full quieting. I'm wondering if they're going to come out with sets like that for digital, because I kind of like the idea of maybe using one in the car, but I'm wondering if they're going to have to use different antennas. The way you're describing it, the antennas are going to have to have gain in them for this new digital, but I'm curious if you've seen any of these smaller sets on the market or if they're going to be practical. And that's about it. This is WB2CUK.
So if I understand correctly, your main question I'm going to be repeating to Eric is how many digital television over-the-air signals are watchable right now? And I'll bet you there's about 15 of them there. What do you think, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, just about all of what you can pick up in analog, you can pick up in digital. The low power is don't transmit digital, but CBS has been transmitting since 99. So, yeah, they started transmitting in 99. We started transmitting in 13. We started transmitting 2001. Yeah, exactly a month to the minute before that building disappeared. Pretty much everybody else has been transmitting digital for the last 3 or 4 years, so it's not like they're all of a sudden just there. They've been there for quite a while.
Yeah, to answer your question, in my way, I don't have a digital setup yet, which is pretty crazy. I'm behind the times. I'm a dinosaur right now. But I had a spectrum analyzer in my hand when I was at a laboratory in Levittown 4 months ago. And so since a digital spectrum analyzer with a preamplifier, the preamplifier had about a 5 dB noise figure, I had nothing but a whip antenna in Levittown, and I was in the second floor of a wooden house. So I was 15 feet above grade in Levittown, not far from Route 106, 107, and with that spectrum analyzer, I went tuning through all of the UHF channels, and I don't know where I looked down that list, but I think I counted at least 15 digital channels on UHF television, which I was getting from that location with that yucky antenna. I was recognizing the very characteristic Barthead-like spectrum signature that's exactly 6 megacycles wide. I mean, when it comes to differentiating an analog television broadcast signal from a digital television broadcast signal, if you know what you're looking at on the screen of a spectrum analyzer, they're night and day. There's no doubt about it as to which one is analog and which one is digital. And I'll bet you I saw about 15. Frank, in 2 hours, so sorry we kept you waiting so long. You got it, Frank.
Okay, thank you, Dick. I just wanted to remind everybody on the net that the DTV transition is not only going to affect our TV sets, over-the-air TV sets, but those of us who have purchased ham gear over the last few years, the recent HTs and mobile units that are capable of receiving the audio portion of the TV broadcast. And some of us use this, you know, to listen to the news, let's say Channel 7 while we're sitting in the diner. This is going to be affected as well. These HTs and mobile units will not be able to receive these TV signals once they switch from analog to digital, unless you have a converter box. So if any of you on that plan to use your ham gear in emergencies when there's no power to listen to the audio portion of the TV news broadcast to find out what's going on, I suggest you purchase at least one converter box just for that purpose. Okay, that's all I have, Dick, and to RSL.
I've got something to say. Go ahead, Eric.
There's legislation sitting in Congress right now that allows a selected broadcaster in each particular service market to maintain one analog transmitter for emergency. So we'll see how that goes. But there's another thing on the horizon that's called mobile, or MA-VSB, which is really 2-VSB or 4-VSB, which if it becomes, as far as the ATSC is concerned, it's just a selected standard. Now it's up to the FCC. If that becomes a standard, then smaller sub-channels will be stuffed in there that you can pick up on handheld devices while you're moving. So it's more robust in terms of being able to pick a symbol out. And the problems of multipath are not nearly as great because it's not as quite a complex thing for the decoder to deal with. KTRW-KE2J.
I got a question on this one, Eric. Let's assume now this is April or May of 2009, and assuming I'm using ordinary ham radio equipment, will there be an analog audio signal I can listen to with a handy talkie during a non-emergency period? I think the answer is no. Do you predict that I can buy a handy talkie in spring of next year, which will be able to demodulate the audio portion of digital television, and therefore give me that audio of television over my handy talkie? K2EJ, K2RIW, and then you. Alex recognized. Eric, you got it.
All right, do I think, Stan, the answer is no, no, no. But if you don't mind listening to 5 kilohertz audio of your news program, all of these city broadcasters use the broadcast auxiliary space between, I think it's 150 and 153. If you tune carefully, I don't have the frequencies off the top of my head, but it's the PL for the various different news organizations. You know, there's one there for CBS, there's one there for NBC. You can hear the director, and you can also hear the news in the background, so, you know, because that's what they're using in a lot of cases to feed PL or ISB and phone back to the performer that's on the camera. And it's usually there 24 hours a day, so whatever the station's playing is usually coming in and out of that spigot. That's one thing. But as the MA standard becomes a standard, you will see probably even ham receivers with some form of digital decoders. It's not going to be that long before you see DRM. Actually, DRM is beginning to show up in some stuff, but it hasn't really shown up in ham stuff yet, but it will. If they go that route, then the European version of the mobile television and the U.S. version of the mobile television is going to show up eventually.
Those ISB frequencies, 150 megacycle frequencies, you can also sometimes hear the director's comments in the background in 2 hours.
That sounds like fun stuff. So I think you're predicting, Eric, that many of the popular brand names of handy talkies will eventually have digital television audio, digital television audio demodulation capability. Is that what you're predicting, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, what usually happens is that they begin to, you know, the RSI gets smaller and smaller and smaller. They generally, because these companies manufacture to the world, they don't manufacture for any one given market. That's why you see so many of these combination chips. So if you buy a video decoder chip today, it doesn't only decode NTSC, it decodes PAL, decodes CCAM, called PowerM, you know. So they bash it all into one chip. There's one chip that's just, you know, it's only another buck or two that they have to add to their cost. So, yeah, eventually, the world digital standard, because more and more of the broadcast stuff is going digital. I mean, you have ubiquity for FM. So you're going to be finding that in your HDs. Now you find your HDs with Bluetooth in it. So, you know, wait a little while.
Do you predict that ham radio itself will start decreasing the use of analog audio and start going over to digital audio techniques in the next couple of years. Do you see that coming down, MS Eric? Go ahead.
No, not really. Amps are cheap, you know. The technology costs money. When it comes to it in a Japanese box, it's included, and it isn't really costing you more. Okay, use more, but there's something about CW that's going to make CW never go away. And when you're talking about low bands, you're really talking about, I want to hear what the guy's saying. I like the way it sounds, you know. There's that human thing. But I don't know if you've ever listened to, like, AOR or some of the other codecs and modems that are out there. This is kind of cheating. I mean, it's like picking up your digital PBX phone, but it works. What can I say? I mean, there's other modes, you know, like PSK32, that can be fun. K2RWK, DJ.
Yeah, when it comes to compressed speech, on some of the cell phones that I've heard, I really don't like the sound of the audio. If it doesn't sound like my friend, I'm not happy, even though it's very intelligible. Alex, N2NNU, go right ahead, K2LIW with the TechNet.
Yeah, I listened to your conversation for a long time here, but I couldn't get to the radio, so perhaps the subject passed a bit. It is about the range of the digital transmissions. I happen to believe that to cut costs in the transitions, the transmission station will not replace their linear power amplifiers, and as such they have to reduce the power when they're going to digital modulation. So this is why the range of the transmission will be much shorter, probably less than 50% that it used to be. Back to you, Rick. Sorry, Dick.
I think it's nowhere near that bad, but Eric is going to give us the rundown on that. The new range and the new power output. KE2EJ, the engineer from channel 21 and 13, K2RIW. You got it, Eric.
KC2QAQ with the cable.
Eric, I mean, Glenn recognized, but Eric first. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, I think we went through this before already, but, okay. Let's, you want to talk about VHF, you want to talk about UHF. The frequency range is still the same. It starts at channel 2, except now it ends at channel 52 or 55, I forget, 52. Sorry, 52 is the last channel, or 53. Now I'm not positive. One or two. So that takes this, it works out better because as you get up into, as you start to get to the real high UHF, you run into more issues than you do on the lower one. So the lower UHF range and the whole of the VHF range. Alright, that's the first thing. Now, we can talk about channel 13 because I know exactly how much power output we had. We used a transmitter produced 24 kilowatts to peak power at sync. And that went into an antenna which had, those antennas are 670, I think it's 60 dB gain. The bat wings, you know what I'm talking about, Dick, but you know there's losses of the combining and that stuff, so. Line up with an ERP, I think that was like 56 kilowatts in that neighborhood. That's VHF, channel 13, 215 megahertz. Another drop. Okay. Now, UHF, the analog on a UHF, I have 60 kilowatts worth of transmitters, and, well, low UHF, so that's a nice place to be. It's at 500 and 517, and, that goes into an antenna that has, 13, so that one's 17 dB gain, right? This gives us a total effective output, an ERP that's 154 kilowatt ERP. Not quite a quarter. Yeah, it's about a quarter of a megawatt. A little bit less. So that's analog. Now, for the same coverage range, let me know your drop. Which is actually slightly shorter than your grade B. It doesn't reach quite far out as the analog does, but it duplicates it pretty much. Okay, so the license for channel 13 is
4.7 kilowatts. And an EOP of 9 point something kilowatts. Now that's before something called maximization, which is coming around. The transmitter I run on UHF, which would be on 22, that's a 4.7 kilowatt transmitter. That goes into an antenna that's got, 11 dB, no, 13 dB gain. And its ERP is 94, 95 kilowatts before maximization. Works actually pretty well, but after maximization, after all the analogs go away and you've been accepted, let me let it drop. So the analog 4.7 kilowatts will become 12 kilowatts, and the UHF 4.7 kilowatts will become, I think, about 9 kilowatts, which will bring the ERP back up to around a quarter of a megawatt, a bit less. No, it's almost a quarter of a megawatt, right. So you can see the difference in terms of before and after maximization, but before maximization, it really ain't a heck of a lot of power when you think about it compared to the analog.
If Alex estimated that the new range when the smoke settles is going to be approximately 80% of the number of miles of range from Empire he's getting now, would that be approximately the right ballpark, do you think, Eric? Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Dick, can you run that by me one more time?
Okay. With his analog television right now, he has a certain number of miles where his grade B coverage takes place from Empire State Building. When the smoke settles and we got the maximization and everything else going on with digital television, do you believe the grade B range will be about 80% of the current analog range? Go ahead.
You know, the interesting thing is with the newer receivers, or the new equalizers on them, you're actually getting really watchable pictures in places where you couldn't get watchable pictures in analog. It's an interesting phenomenon. It has the capability. I've done some DXing now, and it's pretty weird when there's DX happening. But I think that, you know, somebody that's in the boonies that seriously wants to pick it up, they're going to be able to do it. I mean, it'll take a hung up an antenna, but I think it'll happen.
I guess, Nick, go ahead, Alex, much simpler. Go ahead, Alex. I think I wanted to ask is that changing the modulation from analog to digital implies the replacement of the power supplies, of the power amplifiers, or the reduction of the power output of the power supplies, of the power amplifiers, Because as it stands now, the power amplifiers are completely linear, and they cannot run in a digital mode. So without to burn them out. So that was my question. Do you replace the power amplifiers or you run them a half power? That's the question.
I'll bet you every bit of the electronics gets replaced, but the 8 VSB, in order to reproduce it with high integrity, I suspect the new amplifier for digital television is linear as all hell. Am I wrong on that one, Eric? Go ahead.
Oh, you guys, really. There's some magic in this. It's just your biggest enemy, actually, is the differential phase, you know. Time distortion is your biggest problem. Actually, you don't change your power amplifiers. None of that gets changed. I mean, the thing is designed to... When you set up an IoT for an analog, you put a sweep in it, you know, and you make it start at the beginning of your channel edge, and you make it end at the end of your channel edge, you make it as flat as all hell. So you can't get any more linear than you can. I mean, it's a linear device to begin with. And the nice thing about the digital stuff is you feed it a sample of how it messed it up, and it automatically pre-distorts itself to compensate for that. So, no, we're not changing our amplifiers. Actually, in terms of power dissipation, you're running the same amount of electrical power dissipation. What used to be 30 kilowatts of output at a single frequency is now 7 kilowatts that's being spread across 6 megahertz.
So that energy is still there, it's just not at a single point on the dial, so to speak.
Okay. Since less average power is coming out of the amplifier, but it's going to be biased at the exact same point, so therefore the raw power going into it is the same, could I therefore say the amplifier is running a little bit more hotter because it's less RF output for the same DC power input? Over to you, Eric.
Yes, you could say that. This is a linear amplifier, and what we're really doing now is we're taking energy that's not only in amplitude, but we're spreading it across, we're spreading that finite amount of electrical energy over a bandwidth of 6 megahertz. So, if you were to measure the average peak power of a single carrier at one frequency that's maybe half a megahertz wide, where all the energy is, I mean, that's, you're talking about color TV. There's not much energy in the color except, that, you know, maybe a mega and a half up. Also, considering we transmit it upside down, you know, that energy, when you add up all the electrons, it still adds up to the same thing. So, yeah, but I would say that you might think that your tube is running hotter, but if, you know, if you're running, say, 100 kilowatts of electrical energy, and you're getting that output of the single carrier versus the full 6 megahertz all at one time, sounds like you're using the same number of watts to me.
Okay, I got a different question now. In the case of NTSC analog television, I can look at the tip of your vertical interval sync pulse, which I think is your absolute peak envelope power, not counting the audio. That's your absolute peak envelope power, and I think those are the numbers you've been quoting to us. If I now take the 8 VSB Barkhead signal, and I take the worst case peak envelope power, are they close? Over to you, Eric.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm just thinking about what you're saying. Say that again for me.
Okay. Back in the days when I was doing countermeasures engineering, the thing that I had to worry about if I wanted linearity of the system, and I'm putting multiple signals through it, very similar to what would happen if I'm running a bent pipe satellite repeater, and if it wasn't FM modulated, but if it was multiple channels of amplitude modulated television going through that particular traveling wave tube, like say 3 or 4 simultaneous channels, I'd have to worry about the occasional period of time where all 4 signals happen to hit vertical sync pulse maximum power simultaneously, and the tube can the tube handle that with linearity? And if not, I'm going to be splattering. Thank goodness satellites use FM and they don't have that problem. Now, when I look at the Barkhead, I see a whole lot of individual frequencies in there on my spectrum analyzer, and I know that there's a degree of coherency between those individual subcarriers, and at some instant of time they're going to all add up. If I take the worst case addition of all of those subcarriers across that Barkhead, and I talk about the true nanosecond peak envelope power requirement, does digital television have a brand new peak envelope power compared to the analog equivalent? Over to you, Eric.
Okay, now I understand what you're getting at. You've got to consider that the pilot is actually that peak envelope power for the entire ATSC signal, right? And how, in the case of the IoT, which is a little bit different than if you're doing a beam tube, how the tube is biased. Because the biggest enemy that you have throughout all of this, beyond the tube getting saturated and, you know, falling over, so to speak, is group delay. That's the biggest killer of your stuff. So you tend to want to not to operate the tube at the top of the curve. You want that pilot, the peak of the pilot, to be somewhere within a safe level of the tube. So, you know, you were running 30 kilowatts analog peak, which, you know, only happens every 64 microseconds that happens, okay? So there's a period of time that the tube isn't dissipating that much energy. When we're talking about digital, it's continuous for that entire bandwidth. You know, it's just like transmitting like noise. So you really don't want to operate at the top of the tube curves, you know what I mean?
Okay, I think I'm catching on. I think you're telling me there are not individual subcarriers across that 6 meg bandwidth broadcast. I'm rounding off the numbers here. If there were individual carriers, I'd have to worry about the probability of them all going co-phase at one instant at a time. But the nature of the modulation, I think, says that that does not happen. So you're backing off in power in order to gain group delay distortion and linearity. You're not backing off in power in order to make sure you don't exceed the old-fashioned analog peak envelope power. Am I close to what you just said, Eric, go ahead?
Yeah, you're in the right neighborhood. Because you got to consider that the whole signal is peak is peak power. I mean, that's the point of the randomizer in it. So that ensures that there's no coincidence. It's like it's always all coincidence. It's noise. So it's you want to deal with it in time. It's every 94 nanoseconds. Right? There's something happening always. It's the nature of the modulation, but not only the nature of the modulation, but what's done with the data to ensure that that looks like that what you call that digital signal that you see on the spectrum analyzer, that is so highly intentional, as opposed to COFDM, which has a different kind of look to it.
Okay, I've got one further question that's going to bother you on this one. When I talk about human speech, and if I look at the average power of human speech into a linear microphone versus the peak envelope power of human speech, it has at least a 23 decibel crest factor. The peak envelope power, when I say with human speech, is 23 dB louder than the average power when I say ah. Is there a crest factor to digital television signal? Over to you, Eric.
No, and that's totally intentional. It's like going into your microphone forever. So it's not a single frequency. It's all frequencies that you can hear. You know, it's white noise. I mean, we talk about audio, pink noise, but that is a constant level of energy continuously.
Okay, it's very non-analog. The most difficult thing to reproduce with high fidelity is truly Gaussian noise. That's being generated over some particular bandwidth. Pure white Gaussian noise as a jamming process for an electronic countermeasure signal jamming technique is a very severe signal. It's got a huge crest factor. In other words, the amplitude distribution is a Gaussian curve that suggests that if you wait long enough, you're going to get an instantaneous peak requirement that's beyond anything you've ever seen before. And I have the impression that with all the fancy processing going on with digital television, that characteristic is not there. It's not like Gaussian white noise or pink noise. It's more Lauderdale-like, if you know what that means. Lauderdale is a certain kind of folding technique that's used on Gaussian noise before putting it into a transmitter to make sure you don't exceed peak envelope power. I wonder if you ever heard that word before, Eric. Go ahead.
Yes. You'll find the equivalent of that in the process of generating the HPSB because it originates as a double sideband signal. We have to make VSB out of it, so with what they now term as a Nyquist filter, which removes the lower sideband and it limits the actual place where the RF energy is.
Look what you caused here, Eric. I mean, Alex. NU, I hope your question got sort of answered. I heard a lot more than I expected to. NU, KQLIW.
Yeah, okay. I got a feeling that the transmission itself is digital too. In other words, the RF signal is digital also. But if I'm not sure that's happening or not. I understand that there are several different modulation schemes that are put in place here. I'm not sure which one they are, but I don't care. However, I've seen reports that the range of the digital transmissions are very, very short with respect to the analog transmissions. So I was looking for an answer, so that was one answer that I could provide. But it proves that it might not be true, because the transmission itself, the transmitter, the power amplifier is not a class C or a class D amplifier, but still a class A, AB, or whatever. So we'll leave and see. Back to Eric.
Yeah, Eric has convinced me that the nature of digital television modulation and demodulation is, in general, a significant number of decibels more efficient than old-fashioned NTSC analog was. That allows them to cut back the transmitter power and still have close to the same number of miles of grade B coverage. Now, there's some argument going on among the experts as to what that advantage number in decibels is, but digital television does have a certain advantage. It has a number of schemes of forward error correcting built into the transmission scheme. In other words, some of the digital words that are being received can have errors to them. It's a kind of I see it as a kind of batch encoding. That's batch is not the right word I'm looking for. Packet. It's a kind of packet transmission system, and each individual packet has a certain amount of error correcting capability. So an awful lot of the error that you used to get on analog that would create white spots of snow on the screen are not going to do that in digital. You'll either get a completely locked up picture, or you're going to get a beautiful high fidelity picture, and almost nothing in between. Have I misquoted you on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. There's a middle ground. There's that flaky point where it works a little and it stops. It looks like trailing pixels, or pixels will freeze on you. It is that small little area of the cleft, because it's a cliff zone. Either you get it or you don't. The modulation scheme, you can think of the modulation scheme as a scheme that not only has amplitude variation, but it has phase variation. And it happens very quickly. And part of the error correction is, there's one form of it called a trellis, which actually adds another bit to the transmission, to the symbol. And then there's another one called Viterbi, which is on the inside. That is the basic transmission error recoveries. And then inside of that is, there's an MPEG reconstruction process, which is really based on imaginary numbers of what an image looks like. So you can take from before and what came before and what comes after and figure out what it's missing. So there's several different levels of error correction going on. But you basically have it, I think.
I'm rapidly getting the impression, Eric, that the total number of human beings in the United States who really understand this new scheme, other than Mr. Spagnoli, I'm pronouncing his name wrong, you know who I mean. I have the impression there's only a handful of human beings in the United States who truly understand this whole process end to end. And the majority of people who are in the broadcast industry are, from their point of view, buying a black box, hoping they got the right people to install it, and praying that it's all going to work well, because if troubleshooting is required, I think some of those station owners are not going to feel comfortable. Am I wrong on that one, Eric? Go ahead.
That's the detail I can take.
I guess, with your permission, Dick.
Wait a minute. I'll
think that there are two levels of processing here, the baseband processing and the RF processing. The baseband processing is really forward. Nothing special. We're using it in an everyday computer, and they can use that without any problem. Then comes the RF processing, where they do all the Tupa with Viterbi and constellations and whatnot. And that's where the processing gain for RF carrier is occurring. However, I can see consider that if the carrier fails off for at least a second, you have a failure. It is what you're calling a BER, B-E-R, bit error rate to which the failure is concerned. So if you have a frame freeze every 10 seconds, this is the region where the transmitter is not working, even if you have an image on the screen. And to NNU.
Yeah, I pronounced that as Alex and I meant Eric. Sorry about that. I know that Glenn, I think it's QIQ, had something you want to ask. Go ahead, Glenn. Okay. Was there a person who had another question that I haven't covered right now? Give me a call with the name right now.
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead. WD2ICK. Okay. Glenn is back. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, actually, just a quick thing. Somebody was asking before, how many channels can you receive on digital right now? And that right now in Massapequa, I'm getting about 25 channels on digital, where analog, I used to get 10. And my original question was for Eric. On these new digital boxes that are out, I've got a Zenith now, and the output of it is S-Video. The old HDT100 had the nice composite, and you know some of the other features I have the HDMI output. I was wondering, do any of these converter boxes that they have now actually have nice either composite or HDMI type outputs?
Now, the HDT100 has a VGA connector on the back, but that's, it only spits out RGB. I mean, that's how old it is. You're seeing these converter boxes that are coming around, not necessarily for RGB, but you'll see them for component Y and B minus Y, or they call it PIPB. But anyway, getting back to what about the today's broadcasters, and you know, remember that's not a consumer business. I mean, when we write deals with a transmitter manufacturer, we not only write in the contract that it has to work, and we have to accept that it works in order for you to get paid. And most broadcasters have no problem, you know, hey, transmitter's broken, get over there and take care of it. So, there's more and more people coming into the fold that are really beginning to understand how this stuff works, or at least have a decent idea of it. But, you know, how many chief engineers really understand it? I would say more and more and more every day, but maybe not to the levels that we're talking about, but they get a pretty good handle on what's going on. There's a lot of sharing that goes on amongst stations. I know of only what goes on in PBS, and if you see the emails that go around, because we have the bulletin board, people talk about a lot of stuff. K2IW, K2J.
WS2N with the test results.
Oh, go right ahead, Paul.
Okay, I tried what Eric recommended. It worked very good. Took an old black and white, you know, one of these small TVs. And I ran the, put the antenna up, you know, adapter, and then, screwed that into rabbit ears to transmit the R signal. And I plugged it in 10 feet away, worked fine. I'm just wondering, would it be more beneficial to do away with the 75 by 300 ohm? Would I get more range if I did away with that? My guess is it's not, because, you know, but I'm just wondering about that. I tried it with a color TV, a small color TV, that worked good, sound and everything, and then I tried it with the portable black and white one. Oh, it was 1979 vintage TV, and it worked quite well. Back to you, Dick.
Are you saying that you took the 300 ohm lead out of the twin rabbit ears and plugged it straight into an F connector? Is that sort of what you said? And now, if you add a real transformer there, will it work better? And the answer is a little bit better, but it's not going to be night and day, is my impression. Is that the question you were asking, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a question, but in reverse, I didn't make myself clear. I tested it with the transformer, the 300 to 75 ohm transformer. I tested it with that. You know, it was easy to have one. I plugged it into the back of the output of the VCR, and then took the 300 ohm wire from a set of rabbit ears and put it up against the wall, and that was the transmitter, and then the receiver was just the regular TV, black and white TV, with, you know, with the internal antenna. a telescopic antenna. I pulled that out. I tried it real close, and I plugged it in my workroom about 10, 12 feet away, and it still worked fine. You got to move the antennas around to get the better reception, but it worked good. It also worked better in a dipole type fashion. When I had the gravity is close together, standing up vertically against the wall, not too good, but when I opened it up, then it worked really good. Thank you, Jim.
And with a little bit of experimentation, you'll find out there's a magic length of gravity is that'll give you the best reception. But for the first time in your life, you've got over-the-air channel 3 without cable connection. Sounds like fun. There was another person who had a question. Who was that?
WB2IKK.
Mr. IKK, go ahead and start over your name.
Name is George, and it's Whiskey Bravo 2, India Kilowatt Tango. And just a comment, what we see in the broadcast industry with encoding and full digital, we're seeing it all over the place. The cell phone industry is right with it. Everything is certainly digital there. And we've been seeing it, believe it or not, on Ethernet. Your humble Ethernet connection is using encoded signaling, especially when it goes down twisted pair cabling. So you'll see there's a huge variety of cabling and encoding schemes. 100 meg Ethernet using MTL3 coding with 4B5B. Underneath it, the far cry from Manchester coding that it used to be.
Yeah, I think the digital world is here, George. I think it's going to stay. The combination of computers and wireless and RF equipment, I don't think it's just a flash in the pan. I think it's here to stay. Anybody else have any further questions? And if not, I'll give you guys, let me just give you guys a couple of words on what's in the latest issue of QST Magazine. You might want to go looking for it. January 2009, which I got a couple days ago. Nice article called Getting on the Air, Selecting Transmission Lines. It's a 2-page article. So the nice thing about the article is it helps you select the various kinds of transmission lines for the various services, everything from 600 ohm open wire line down to 50 ohm line. But they've got a very nice curve of what is the extra loss in decibels because your line is running at either a low or a high standing wave ratio. Rather nice curve on that one. When it comes to, that was, by the way, the one I just mentioned to you is on page 71. On page 76 is something called Hands-On Radio, where it gives a very nice explanation of the scattering parameters. You've heard lots of guys on this repeater from time to time talk about an antenna with a 10 dB reflection coefficient. It's called S11, and we call that a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. So the relationship between standing wave ratio and reflection coefficient or reflected power and forward power, fairly nicely described on page 76 and page 77 of the January 2009 issue of QST Magazine. If there's no one else with any further question, Mel's going to open up his mailbag and we're going to try to please some of those people. So, okay, I'll take a standby if anybody has any further questions right now. K2RI, if you're listening.
WS2R with a quick space report.
Yeah, I should have asked for that. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, not long, Dick. A couple of weeks ago, NASA met Michael Griffin and the group, and they decided to delay the launch of the Mars Science Laboratory from 2009 October to 2 years down the road, probably the same time frame except 2011. This is a $500 billion project. $500 million project. Not million. That's been delayed. It's a new rover that's being designed. You've got Opportunity and Spirit on Mars now, and this thing is, they just got to send one, not two, and it's roughly eight times the size of Spirit and Opportunity. So runs on plutonium, no solar panels. Should be an interesting mission once they do it. They ran into problems with actuators. I can tell you more if you want to hear about that. Why the delay? Back to you, Dick. WS.
Yeah, I think I do want to hear a little bit more about that. In other words, for them to solve all the problems and launch on time was getting iffy. And When you do a launch to a mission to Mars, you have to wait until Mars and Earth have the right alignment with reference to each other. And I have the impression that alignment occurs once every 2 years on average. So I think that's the main reason for the two-year delay. It isn't because an actuator problem caused the two-year delay. It caused the two-year delay where you're going to miss this particular comet, so to speak. I mean, if you're building yourself a telescope, and you want to, you're building yourself a spacecraft, and you want to encounter a comet as it goes whizzing by the Earth. That's a train where you've got to be at the station at exactly the right time to catch it. If you end up a day late, forget it. You're going to miss the comet. And that's sort of what happens when it goes to Mars. You've got to be in the right place at the right time. So I'm guessing that's approximately the two-year delay. Is that true? And what happened to the actuator? Over to you, Paul.
Okay, yeah, it's probably a little longer than 2 years, but call it 2 years. People want to really think about it. The way they come up with that is, you know, Earth goes around the sun in 1 year, and Mars, well, a little longer than 2 years, but call it 2 years. So if the Earth goes around, you know, figure 1 year, and it comes back to the same place, Mars goes roughly about halfway around. So, you know, you're on the other side of it. On the other side of the sun, so you can't launch every year. But now picture another year going by, the Earth goes around again and comes back again in the same place, but now that next year goes by and now Mars comes around the other half and you're back in the same place where you started. So it's roughly, 2 years, a little greater than 2 years. But the actuators are, there's some 39, I think, actuators on board this thing. Many, many more than what's on Opportunity, for instance. And bigger. A lot of them are bigger. And each one is very complex. It's a combination of motors and gearing system. Everything that operates on the road is, you know, the arms and the wheels. And everything works on these motor actuators. And each one has, you know, like they said, 500 little parts in each one, and they're having trouble with them. For instance, similar to what we have with some of these rotated, supposed to send the signal back to let you know exactly, you know, where the rotator is at that particular time. Well, same thing with the actuators. Where are the wheels? Where's the arm that's scooping something up? They've had some problems with that, and they're going to have to redesign that. A lot of things are involved with software and everything between the actuators. And things will have to be changed. So they basically run out of time. They were pushing for an early launch, but they left themselves open a while back, saying, you know, it could go 2 years down the road, and that's the way it's planned now to do that. So that's the story on the Mars Science Laboratory. Dick, back to you, WS1.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Anyone else with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. There being none, Mel, did you get any interesting mail this week? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. All right, one more thing. I was just going to finish up on digital television reception. There are very few people around here that are still receiving, you know, TV reception over the conventional antenna on this block, maybe two or three, I think, at the most, being one of them. And we got circulars in the door saying that they did take a survey. This company came down the block and they looked, and anyone that did have still a TV antenna up on a chimney or whatever, that they put in the door that you will not be able to get digital television reception. So basically, I also got a number of questions like this from the email. So just to put it all at rest, in other words, after February, the antenna is not a special antenna. If you're getting decent reception now, in other words, you can continue with it. Basically, I guess the new antenna that they're trying to put up for you is a much simpler antenna, you know, smaller antenna, because it doesn't have to cover the low VHF channels, correct?
That's my best understanding. I think channels 2, 4, and 5, I think, are going to disappear. Not a guarantee, but I think they're going to disappear as far as over-the-air broadcast is concerned. And other than that, I agree with everything that's been said. Over to you, Mel.
Okay, so no rush for them to jump into having the antenna changed up on the chimney or the roof, because they're not going to all of a sudden see no reception. And by the way, I did pick up a box also, the Zenith DTT 901. I just would like to see how it works. I haven't done anything with it as of yet. But I passed by a place, they had them on sale, so I picked up one. And I'm going to give it a try and see exactly what I will receive at this location. I assume you're going to do the same thing, Dick. Is that your plan, or do you have some other ideas about, because I know you're basically doing the same thing as I am, and not receiving over a cable system, over.
In the town of Huntington, when I go driving around, I can't find anybody with a rooftop antenna that looks like it's even partially operational. Mine is the only one. I may be the only person with over-the-air television reception. Now, I can get away with that because my house is 300 feet above sea level. I had at one time one antenna. I got an antenna on the chimney. I've got a second antenna at the 60-foot level of one of my towers, which used to have a rotator on it, and that's got to be repaired. So I'm an over-the-air television DXer, and I'm going to continue to get over-the-air. I'm not likely to suddenly go out and buy cable. It's just something that I never got around to doing. And
if food for thought, how about a disc cone for TV?
A disc cone? Disc cone? No. That's a vertically polarized antenna. And television transmission is horizontal.
And it's sideways.
Okay. That's a possibility. However, that's a very low-gain antenna, a disc cone. It's basically a monopole. And unless you're pretty close, like Mel is, I don't think you're going to get good Empire State Building reception with a disc cone. That's a guess on my part. Now, if you look at the latest issue of QST Magazine, you'll find out that the ARRL has been asked by the FCC for amateurs to try to help, not by visiting their neighbors, not by doing the installation, but by handing out literature and talking to people, telling them a little bit about what digital television is. Apparently the FCC and the National Association of Broadcasters are both kind of concerned that even though it's on the internet, it's in the newspapers, it's on every television channel, it's on radio programs, whatever, the message that the day of reckoning, February 17, is coming, lots and lots of efforts have been put forth to make sure everyone knows. Well, they're realistic enough to know that a certain percentage of the people are ignoring all of those warnings, and they're going to be complaining vociferously on February 18th. What did you do to make my set go black? So amateurs are being asked to assist in explaining, giving literature, and whatever. But they're not being asked to visit homes and do the installation. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, this is K2KEY. I can see that there'll be complaints what did you do to knock out my TV this time? This is, yes, a situation. You know, you just hit upon a very good point before we go. Leave the subject. About TBI, is there going to be a different form of TBI problems? I know it's sort of not too much acute as it was years ago, but if there is any kind of a problem with TBI and these converter boxes, Dick, over.
I'm guessing the answer is no. No significant difference. If you don't have television interference now, and channel 2, 4, and 5 are the ones that get interfered with the most of the time, and those channels are essentially disappearing, and so only the upper VHF and UHF channels are left, I think there's not going to be any significant increase in television interference from ham radio transmissions next door. The thing that I think digital television is most vulnerable to is a kind of impulse noise that takes place if your power line is arcing over. A certain number of people are not going to get great reception on some of the channels if they have to have an arcing power transformer very near their house. But ham radio operation tends not to modulate in that manner. So I don't think we're going to create a great problem. The error correcting that's built into the reception, I think it's going to take out most of the non-linearities of slight overload that might take place because the ham radio next door is transmitting a kilowatt on, let's say, 21 megacycles. Over to you, Mel, KQRIW.
KQ2QIQ with comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I've done some experimenting because I've got, you know, the receiver here in the house, and I've got, you know, pretty much covering, you know, from 40 down to 160 meters. And the only two bands that I see that do have an interference is basically 10 meters. When you go above, well, when I operate above 100 watts, I can see some pixelation, and 6 meters. The two old-fashioned defenders, there they are again. Yeah, those would probably be the only two bands that that I can see so far that affect it.
When you did get that television interference effect on either 10 meters or 6 meters, what television channel was the one that was being affected?
Everyone, Dick. I don't know. I don't believe it was actually coming in from the HF side. I think it was some other middle conversion inside the box, and it might have been, you know, here again, it's in the same proximity, you know, the same QTH. So here again, and it was pixelation type of distortion. You know, you just you don't lose the whole channel. You just, like, pieces of pixels start disappearing. And the only two bands I saw it on was 6 and 10 meters. But there again, it was all the channels. It wasn't just one or two.
Were you running 100 watts of sideband when you saw this effect, Glenn?
Yeah, exactly. Above 100. Above 100, that's where you start to see some effect. 6, I think maybe a little lower. Anything above 50 watts, you might start to see some problems.
How close is your ham radio antenna from the television receiving antenna?
They're pretty darn close, Dick. They're not that far away. You know, they're maybe on you know, opposite ends of the house, or let's put it this way, they're within 25 feet.
And somewhat broadside to each other, I'm going to guess. And I guess the next question would be, if you had a high-pass filter on the television reception antenna, would the interference still be there?
Yeah, that's something I don't have enough information on yet, Dick. Maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't, but my impression from what I could see was the type of interference seemed to be affecting the box more than actually coming in from the RF signal. But there again, I don't have enough information yet to make an accurate comment on that. But it does, those were the two bands that I saw. But, I mean, even running a kilowatt down, you know, 80, 160, 40, 20, the other bands, no problems there. 440, 144, no issues. But I think if you're going to have an issue, it's probably going to be either on 10 or 6, from what I can see. And here again, probably some filters may help.
Okay. Those are the channels that in the old days were the big interferers. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. I think we sort of covered television and associated situations involving amateur radio. As far as I can say, talking to neighbors, it's a ticklish subject. I keep a low profile, especially with the neighbors, because for some reason people right away act strange when a ham talks to them, because, you know, first of all, you're just introducing yourself and why, and then saying something about, you know, what will happen. Right away it will be equated that you are going to have something to do with causing this problem, you know, with loss of reception and everything. So I don't know. I'm very apprehensive about walking around the neighborhood and ringing bells or anything of that sort, Dick. Over.
I'm with you, Eric. I mean, Mel, I'm with you on that one. However, in the various places I've lived, there's usually a couple of people in the neighborhood who say, hey, I see by the antennas you've got in your backyard or on your house, you're a person who is interested in electronics. Therefore, could you help me? I've got this electronic problem. When a person approaches you and asks for help, the fact that you've got the literature and got some of the information, I think is the right way to go. But I certainly wouldn't go knocking on doors because, as they say, let that sleeping dog lie. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Actually, I 100% agreement because I... I know what will be the response. I've been at this a lot of years,
And I know that I can tell you some funny stories, but no use getting into them about things.